Good morning, barely. Thank you for your patience. The last case on our calendar today is 818-1923, State of Minnesota versus Donald Eugene DeGroat Jr. Council will each have 15 minutes for your argument, and appellant will have 5 additional minutes for rebuttal. If you could please, go ahead and be seated. I'm sorry. If you can please introduce yourself at the beginning of the argument and your client, we would appreciate that for the recording. And you can adjust the podium as necessary. Counsel for appellant can proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. May it please the Court, my name is Jessica Merz-Gaddis, and I represent the appellant, Donald DeGroat. Mr. DeGroat was convicted of possessing methamphetamine police found in a rear cargo area of a Jeep in which Mr. DeGroat was one of 4 occupants. He has raised 4 issues in his principal brief, and I'd like to suggest to the Court today that this case is really much simpler than the 100 pages of briefing in this matter might otherwise suggest. Really, I think this comes down to 2 very simple ways to resolve this case, one with respect to the sufficiency issue and one with respect to the suppression issue. So I'd like to address my comments to that today, and of course I'm happy to answer any other questions the Court has. To start with the suppression issue, all this comes down to is that the tracking warrant was based on the uncorroborated tip of 3 cooperating individuals whose reliability and basis of knowledge was not established. I suggest to the Court that this case is very similar and, in fact, even better than the case of State v., I believe it's pronounced Mizo, cited in my brief for you. In that case, what we had was a warrant where 4 persons said that the defendant possessed controlled substances with the intent to sell them, and those 4 had in fact admitted to buying drugs from that defendant. The Supreme Court, on that basis, had no trouble concluding that that affidavit was deficient on its face. Here, our affidavit is even more lacking than that, because here we don't even have a claim that these cooperating individuals ever purchased drugs from Mr. DeGroat. All we have here is that these cooperating individuals claimed that Mr. DeGroat travels to Minneapolis to buy methamphetamine, which he then sells in their local area. The problem
in the application for the first search warrant, it is more detailed than in the Mezzo case in that it specifies that the cooperating individuals indicated that DeGroat travels to Minneapolis to purchase 5 pounds of meth and then travels back to Becker, Minoman, and Otter Tail areas and distributes the meth, and he does this approximately every 3 to 4 weeks. So would you agree that that's a distinction between the Mezzo case?
Well, I would agree that it's a distinction to the extent that, as a factual matter, that the Mezzo case didn't involve a claim of where he went to purchase the methamphetamine. But I don't think it's a meaningful distinction for the purpose of this Court resolving the issue. Because what we have here, the fundamental problem with the warrant that we have here is an absolute lack of any information about any of these 3 people. We don't know anything about them, and we don't know anything about their basis of knowledge. Of course, when this Court looks at a warrant that's based on a tip from an anonymous informant, of course the Court is going to look at reliability, basis of knowledge, and corroboration. All of that is lacking in this case. There's no claim that any of these 3 has ever provided any reliable information in the past. The state's argument essentially wants this Court to assume that these were 3 separate individuals who separately had the information and separately related to law enforcement. We don't even know that that's true. For all we know, based on the information that's put in this application, these 3 people could have all been busted at the same time and all offered up this same bit of information in one conversation to multiple officers. We
so
don't
the,
know.
The district court interpreted the application to indicate that those three individuals corroborated each other. Do you think that was erroneous?
I do, and I think that misconstrues what this court looks at when you're talking about corroboration. The corroboration analysis looks at what information was provided by the informants and were the police able to corroborate that. So here the information that's provided by the informants is that Mr. DeGroat travels to Minneapolis to buy methamphetamine and brings it back to the local area. There's nothing about any of that information that's corroborated at all. There's nothing even corroborating that he's ever sold methamphetamine to anyone anywhere. Oftentimes what we'll see in warrants is when there's an allegation from an informant that a particular person is selling controlled substances, the officers will take the time to or make the effort to do a controlled purchase to somehow corroborate that, yes, in fact, he is selling. We don't even have that here. And again, as I mentioned before, we don't have an allegation that these informants had ever themselves bought from Mr. DeGroat in the past. So that brings us into the basis of knowledge analysis that you'll do. There's no way for us to know how they had this information. For all we know, this could have been a rumor that's circulating out there that they all are aware of and they're all repeating. They don't say anything about any of them have ever accompanied him on this kind of a trip. They don't even claim that they themselves have ever seen Mr. DeGroat possess any amount of methamphetamine, let alone large quantities, let alone sell it to anyone. As I've already said, they have not themselves bought methamphetamine from Mr. DeGroat. They don't even claim to know him personally. The officers in this case don't even bother to show a photograph of Mr. DeGroat to these people to confirm that the person that they're identifying as Mr. DeGroat, the seller, is in fact Mr. DeGroat. For all of these reasons, this affidavit is deficient on its face, just like the affidavit was in the Mezzo case, even more so.
Even given the extremely deferential standard?
Even given that, Your Honor, because what this court will do is give a deferential standard to the idea or to the analysis of whether the issuing magistrate had a substantial basis to issue the warrant. And here, that substantial basis is utterly lacking for the reasons I've discussed, for the fact that it's a bare assertion by these three individuals whose reliability is not established, whose basis of knowledge is not established, and there's no corroboration of anything that they've said. There's no basis, let alone a substantial basis, for the issuing magistrate to have determined probable cause existed here. Turning to the second issue that I'd like to address, the sufficiency.
Well, let's go back to the first issue for
a
minute. Is there any evidence in the record that the police had an independent basis for locating Mr. DeGroat at the Holiday Station at the time he was arrested there? In other words, is there any other evidence in the record or independent basis that would support the search?
There is no evidence in the record, Your Honor, and I'm glad you bring this point up, that the police would have had any reason to know that Mr. DeGroat was at that Holiday Station but for the tracking warrant. So that is why, on appeal, Mr. DeGroat's argument focuses exclusively on the probable cause for this tracking warrant. Because if there's no probable cause for that, the record clearly establishes that that is the only reason they knew he was at that Holiday Station and they found him there. Everything falls like dominoes from there. The evidence discovered in the vehicle search is the fruit of the initial illegality. So to that end, there are several subsections in respondent's brief that address alternate suppression theories that were raised by Mr. DeGroat at the district court level. Those have not been pursued on appeal, and they're unnecessary for this court to decide for purposes of this appeal. We really are focusing on the probable cause for the tracking warrant, and the methamphetamine is the fruit of that illegality.
What do you mean they have not been pursued on appeal? I understand the responsive brief to make alternative arguments.
What I mean by that, Your Honor, is that Mr. DeGroat at the district court level also challenged whether there was a reasonable articulable suspicion for the dog sniff. That's not something that I've pursued on appeal.
You're not pursuing that.
But
the state is making alternative arguments, I think, just, you know, that even if the tracking warrant is invalid. There's other things, such as the independent source and so on.
I understand. I'm sorry.
I was going to ask whether all those arguments were preserved below.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not remembering specifically anything other than defense counsel's challenge to the dog sniffed based on no reasonable articulable suspicion. I know that she made a series of more specific and challenges to the discovery of the methamphetamine below, and I'm just not now remembering what those were. In terms of the sufficiency issue, the one thing I wanted to address with the court today to be clear about is that what respondent's brief does, like the district court did when it was denying Mr. DeGroat's motion for a judgment of acquittal, is focus on the circumstances proved that are consistent with guilt. That's fine, but that's only half the analysis. This course, as you know, of course, looks beyond that to what other inferences can be drawn from the circumstances proved, and whether those circumstances proved preclude the reasonable inference that he did not possess the methamphetamine in this case. Here, they do not. In fact, the circumstances proved leave open the possibility that any one of those other three occupants of the car could have possessed the methamphetamine. The most important fact I want this court to be clear about in this regard is that the trial record does not include evidence that the police were acting on a tip that Mr. DeGroat specifically drives down to the Minneapolis area every 3 to 4 weeks to purchase the methamphetamine to bring back. That evidence is in the pretrial record only. It did not come in at trial, so it's not evidence that forms a circumstance proved that this court can use for purposes of the sufficiency analysis. The actual circumstance proved that you have is merely that police were investigating Mr. DeGroat for trafficking methamphetamine. That's fine. That renders reasonable the inference of his guilt. But it does not preclude the inference that he was not knowingly possessing the methamphetamine that was found in the car at this time. Let's remember that what we have among the three other occupants here are a front seat passenger who is in actual possession of methamphetamine, a back seat passenger who is in actual possession of methamphetamine, and we have a driver who is not Mr. DeGroat, and we have a statute, 152.028, which allows for the reasonable inference that the driver is the one who is in possession of any controlled substance found in a car. So we clearly, from the circumstances proved here, have a reasonable inference that it was someone other than Mr. DeGroat who possessed that methamphetamine. Let's remember it was concealed in an opaque bag that was in the rear cargo area of the Jeep that was not plainly visible and equally accessible to everyone in that vehicle.
I have a question about the cargo area. This was an SUV. Some SUVs have like a retractable screen that might go horizontally across the back area. Was there anything in the record about whether this vehicle had that and whether it was covering the storage area or not?
I don't remember any evidence in the record specific to that point. What you'll see in the record is photographs that were taken before the police searched the vehicle, and there's no kind of retractable covering that's up at that time. It seems to just be, at least from the photograph that's taken, a general open area that's behind the rear passenger seats.
And could you remind me of all the things that were back there? Besides the Crown Royal bag?
There wasn't much back there. The other thing that you can see clearly in the photographs is there is a plastic bag, like a grocery shopping type bag, that's also in the back cargo area. Importantly, there's nothing in, let me put it this way.
Not a lot of luggage either.
No, there's not a lot of luggage for sure. And there's nothing about the location of what is found in the back of the Jeep that renders unreasonable the inference that Mr. DeGroat was not in possession of that methamphetamine. As the district court, I think, correctly concluded in this case, all we know from where the police found that methamphetamine is there's two reasonable inferences. Somebody, we don't know who, any one of those four, or perhaps even somebody else, placed the methamphetamine directly where it was found by the police. So it was there the whole time. or another reasonable inference from its location is that it was jostled around during the drive or perhaps during the towing, because recall it was towed from the gas station to the police station to be searched. Maybe it was jostled, maybe it started out somewhere else altogether. We just don't know.
But we do know that there were, that Mr. DeGroat had rubber bands found on him that were identical to rubber bands found in one of those, in the plastic bag.
So two things.
That was in the back.
Yep.
And the plastic bag, at least at the time of the search, in the photo appears to be near the Crown Royal bag.
So two things about that, Your Honor.
And we know that he also had a large amount of money on his person.
Right. So two things about that, Your Honor. First and foremost, most importantly, the theme that I'd like to express here today and I hope to leave you with is that while those circumstances that you can point to, that respondent has pointed to, that would render reasonable the inference that he did knowingly possess that methamphetamine, the question for you is, do they preclude the reasonable inference that he does not? And our argument is they do not, because remember, those rubber bands that were found in his pocket that matched the rubber bands that were in the plastic bag, that doesn't actually link him to the methamphetamine, because the methamphetamine is not packaged in individual bindles for sale. The methamphetamine is essentially two large bricks that are wrapped in tissue and then in the opaque Crown Royal bag and are separate from that plastic bag.
Weren't there some pills, too?
I don't recall a reference in the records to there being any pills. But even if there were, those pills were not in the same bag that the methamphetamine was in. So I see my time is up, Your Honor. I'm happy to answer any other questions, or I'll just defer to my rebuttal time.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Moved into afternoon.
May it please the court, my name is Scott Hersey. I'm a special assistant Wadena County attorney, and I represent the respondent in this appeal. I would like to start by simply pointing out that the standard of review of district court's determination of probable cause for a search warrant is that the reviewing court should afford the issuing court's decision great deference. And the standard also is not de novo, but a reviewing court need only find that the issuing court had a substantial basis for concluding that probable cause existed.
The language in the first warrant is it's very brief in support of the application. How does that provide a substantial basis for finding probable cause?
In certain respects, I would liken that to the simple letter that was sent to the police, the Illinois police, in Illinois v. Gates, and it simply described what this person's MO was. And that's exactly what this particular search warrant did with the information from three cooperating individuals. And in some of this court's case law and the Supreme Court case law, including, I believe, Gates, they use the term self-verifying detail. And here, as the court pointed out to counsel, there were more details than in the Mezzo case. The individual said that the defendant was selling large quantities of methamphetamine in specific locations, Minoman, Becker, and Ottertail counties, and that he had a methodology that he would go to the metro or Minneapolis area every 3 to 4 weeks, and he would buy specific quantities of methamphetamine, a specific drug, in 5-pound increments, and then return and sell it. And this was an ongoing activity. And what makes this case different from Mezzo, I would suggest, is the ability to predict what the defendant was going to do. And as with Illinois v. Gates, it shows a detailed knowledge of his operation from someone or some people with inside information. It's not just casual rumor. It's not that they got the information just from casual talk, but they got their information in a reliable way. And
doesn't the record need to indicate, though, the credibility of the cooperating individuals and the basis for their information?
Reliability and basis of knowledge were very specific requirements for upholding a search warrant under the Aguilar-Spinelli test. And that was abandoned by the Supreme Court in Gates. And they said those can be considerations, but those are just considerations, not requirements in the totality of the circumstances test that Gates adopted and that the Minnesota courts have since followed. And so I would submit that there is some corroboration here. As the district court found, we have three different cooperating individuals, and they corroborated each other. And a case that I cited in my brief, State versus Hochstein, does indicate that the case law in Minnesota says that one informant can corroborate another informant.
But there isn't really any information in the search warrant application that shows they corroborated each other. It just states that officers have been informed by three cooperating individuals that DeGroat is selling large quantities of meth. It doesn't say that officers were informed by three individuals at different times or separately, you know, by three individuals separately.
That is true, but the district court...
There's no indication that... What is the basis for concluding that it was done separately, as the district court seems to have concluded? Because I don't see that from the language in the application itself.
Well, I think the district court also said that the term used, cooperating individuals, suggested that the individuals came forward voluntarily. And a person coming voluntarily to
police...
How
would we know that? I just want to make sure it's corroborating, not cooperating.
Right.
So we're just supposed to assume that corroborating means cooperating voluntarily?
Well, the district court made the determination that that was corroboration, and also that they were cooperating and they came forward voluntarily. The district court basically found two of the Ross factors.
Well, how does it get... Okay. It certainly says corroborating. What I'm unclear about is how the district court got from corroborating to cooperating without explaining that.
Perhaps I can put it in this light, Judge. When the district court reviewed this at the contested omnibus hearing, the district court had before it three search warrants. Two search warrants that were issued by Minoman. One was a tracker warrant. One was for the defendant's Jeep himself and his house. And the third warrant was the warrant that was issued by the Wadena court for the Jeep. And the court referenced all of those in its findings in its omnibus order. And I think it's fair then to look at the second search warrant, which actually was not executed, but it was issued by the Minoman District Court. And in that search warrant, the same affiant as in the first search warrant specifically talks about a control buy with a confidential, reliable informant, CRI. But
that wasn't the basis for the third search warrant.
No, I'm talking about the second search warrant. But my point is that the officer also referenced CRI and cooperating individuals in the second one. What that does show is it does show that the officer clearly made the distinction between those two individuals and suggests those two types of informants, and suggests when the officer uses the cooperating individual in the first search warrant, he is not talking about someone in the criminal milieu. Otherwise, he would have used the CRI term that he used in the second search warrant.
That wasn't the analysis that the district court went through, though.
That is not the district court's analysis, but I think that's a fair consideration when one looks at the fact that the district court used all three search warrants in its analysis. And it is true that in the Gates situation, the police officers were able to do some independent corroboration, but an important point for the U.S. Supreme Court was the self-verifying detail that indicated that whoever was providing this information got it reliably. And they came forward to the police as a cooperating individual, and even though they provided it anonymously, they did provide that information. And the detail and the prediction of the future behavior is what allowed the Supreme Court to decide that that was sufficiently reliable.
So can you help me out here? It's not clear to me why consideration of the second warrant, it's not clear to me that the district court actually considered the second warrant. I thought in its motion to suppress, or order
you
on the
You may be
to
correct,
suppress.
But I believe there's a reference to it as an exhibit in its order.
Well, but not in the analysis.
Correct. You are correct. I'm simply saying that those facts show, and I think this court can determine it from the facts, that the affiant in the first and second search warrants certainly knew the difference between a CRI type of informant and a cooperating individual not involved in the criminal milieu, and I think that justifies an inference that that person is more reliable than someone that is a CRI, as in the second search warrant, who's actually out buying methamphetamine from a seller, namely Mr. DeGroat.
Doesn't that require us to read a lot into the language that's used without any actual testimony from the officers involved regarding how they use particular language? I mean, it seems like you're asking us to make a lot of assumptions about this specific language.
Well, I'm asking the court to just take notice of the facts contained in the particular search warrants. And I'm suggesting to the court that the district court did, in fact, believe that these cooperating individuals, as that term was used, are people that are sufficiently reliable that it gave the court a basis, a substantial basis, to issue the search warrants.
But those individuals weren't ever identified.
Pardon me?
Those individuals weren't identified. They were just listed as cooperating individuals.
That is correct, Judge. That is correct. But I would submit, even aside from the first tracker warrant, there were several other bases for the officers to go ahead and search the vehicle. As indicated, as things developed, they had outside warrants to be able to arrest the defendant. They did, in fact, arrest him. They found methamphetamine on two of the other occupants of the vehicle. They had sufficient reasonable suspicion to go ahead and have a dog sniff done. The dog did a positive alert to the rear cargo area, and, in fact, the methamphetamine was found right behind where the defendant, Mr. DeGroat, was. And I think it's pertinent.
But, I mean, all of that, you wouldn't have been at the gas station without the tracking warrant, right? I mean, I think it would be a different case if, you know, they just kind of were driving around and, you know, what do you know? There he is. But the only reason they're at the gas station is because of the tracking warrant. So, and that sort of leads to everything else, right?
I don't know that I could actually say that, Judge.
Well, when you look at the transcript, it seems pretty clear from Agent Mark Pinoniemi, I'm not sure how you pronounce his name.
I can't pronounce
name,
it either, Judge.
That the reason the police went to the gas station was based on the tracking of Mr. DeGroat coming back from Minneapolis. Can you point to any testimony in the transcript that shows the police had independent knowledge or of him being at the gas station?
I can't off the top of my head, other than to say that there is some testimony that another officer was actually surveilling and following him in a vehicle.
But
other than that, I can't point to a specific part of the transcript. What I would suggest is that that was not an issue that was at the forefront during the omnibus hearing. And I would suggest to the court that perhaps a situation as in a case from this court from 1996, State versus Lieberg, Lieberg, 553 Northwest 2nd at 51, would be appropriate. In that particular case, there had been a search warrant, I believe, and that information had been suppressed in a separate case. In a second search warrant, the police officers referenced that and then went ahead and did a search warrant. And the issue for the appellate court in that case was, is there a but-for argument here? Would they still have done the second search warrant without the information from the first warrant? And the appellate court said, on this record, we cannot make that factual determination, and therefore they remanded that to the district court. And Lieberg has since been followed by State versus Waters, 814-1266, and I can provide a supplemental authority letter on those cases. And if that is the crux of the court's decision in this case, then I would submit that the remedy is to have that factual determination explored, because that was not explored by the district court. I think that is a factual determination that's beyond the record that we have, and a remand on that particular issue would be appropriate.
Could you, I'm unclear, Mr. Hersey. The alternative arguments that you have made at pages, I think, 27 to 32, there are several. Were all of them asserted by the state in the district court?
I cannot say specifically that they were asserted by the district court. I believe.
No, I mean, it asserted to the district court. It did the prosecutor in the district court proceedings make all of these arguments in the alternative to the main issue about probable cause?
Probably not the Carroll doctrine, but I believe the district court in its order addressed the other issues. The court talked in terms of the officers having the additional information, the ability to make a search incident to a lawful arrest under Arizona versus Gantt, and things of that nature. So based upon the district court addressing those, I'm perhaps making a leap of faith, but I'm assuming that those were matters that were addressed in the district court. And as mentioned, there were a number of alternative bases besides the search warrants. I would simply make the point very quickly. I would ask the court to give the good faith doctrine consideration here. I referenced that in my brief. This court may feel constrained because of the fact that...
It hasn't been adopted?
It has been limited by the Supreme Court in State versus Lindbergh. But I would ask the court to take into account State versus Buchholz, a decision from the Supreme Court in 1980, where the Supreme Court addressed the issue here of good faith, where it said, as we stated in State versus Nolting, the exclusionary rule is directed at police misconduct. Here the police officer acted in good faith and did his best to comply with Fourth Amendment requirements by going to a magistrate and relying on the magistrate to make a determination of probable cause. Applying the exclusionary rule in such a case would not deter police misconduct, but would punish good police conduct. So I'm a bit puzzled by the Lindbergh case attempting to limit the good faith doctrine when it appears to have relied on that as a basis for one of its prior decisions all the way back to 1980. So I would ask the court to give that consideration, and I would ask the court to uphold the district court's rulings. Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Your Honors, to the point that you were questioning respondents' counsel about regarding, was there any independent or any evidence in the record that the police had any independent basis for discovering the Jeep at the Holiday, I'd point you to addendum page 21 of appellant's brief. That is the officer's application for the third warrant in the case, and that very clearly establishes for you that they were monitoring the tracking warrant, and it's only because of monitoring the tracking warrant that they knew Mr. DeGroat drove down to Minneapolis on a given day and then turned around the next day and came back. So they put that right in there in their application for their warrant to search the vehicle. And then, as Your Honor, Judge Cochran pointed out, I think the testimony is pretty clear throughout the trial as well, that these officers were simply monitoring the tracking warrant. That's how they knew that he made that trip, and that's why they all started paying attention and they all started amassing vehicles and officers in the area to intercept him upon his return. There's no independent basis for them finding the Jeep. As to the point that was discussed regarding this confusion about the district court's finding that these cooperating individuals came forward voluntarily, It's an inference that the district court makes. And in its ruling, the district court very clearly says that it's an inference that these cooperating individuals came forward voluntarily. That's too much of a leap to make because, as already discussed here in my principal argument, all that we know from the information that's provided is that these three people shared this information. And we don't know how that came about, and it could have easily been that they themselves were apprehended on criminal behavior of their own part, and in an effort to curry favor with law enforcement, they start bringing forth this information about DeGroat, which, again, for all we know, is completely false. Maybe it's a rumor that's out there circulating that they know about. As I've pointed out for you in the briefing, this is akin to what past courts have called, perhaps this is a, quote, stool pigeon situation, where these folks, out of their own self-interest, are offering up their information, supposed information about Mr. DeGroat, to get out of trouble themselves. There's nothing in this affidavit that indicates that they came forward out of the blue voluntarily into the police station as concerned citizens out of the goodness of their heart to offer up this information. So for those reasons, with those clarifications, and for the reasons argued in the brief and here today, we would ask that this court find that this affidavit was deficient on its face and reverse the district court's suppression ruling.
So if we agree with you that the suppression ruling should be reversed, do we reverse and remand?
Your Honor, there would... If this court were to reverse and remand, as a practical matter, there would be no basis for the prosecution to be able to go forward with a prosecution in this case. The evidence would be suppressed. There would be no basis for them to prosecute.
So
I think in recent past cases where the Court of Appeals has found that evidence was discovered as the result of an unconstitutional search, this court has reversed and remanded even where it was an essential piece of evidence.
I would agree that there are cases where when the suppression issue results in a reversal, it also results in a remand because there may be in other cases other factual circumstances or evidence in the record that would allow the state to go forward with the prosecution. I mean, I suppose in theory they could try in this case. I just don't know how they could do it without the actual methamphetamine. That's the best answer I can give the court.
Okay, thank you.
So if we were to grant the relief you're seeking on the first issue, is it necessary for us to review and decide the other issues?
It is not, Your Honor. It is not. Similarly, if the court were to grant relief on the sufficiency issue, you would not have to address the other issues. Or if the court were to grant relief on the speedy trial issue, you would not have to address the other issues. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both for your arguments and for your briefing. The matter was well briefed and well argued. The matter is submitted. Have a good rest of your day.
Nice job, as usual.
Oh, thank you very much.
You know, so I
just hope.